brief period. If it happens in the right part of the RST wave of a electrocardiogram, so to speak, it could still send you into fibrillation, even though the machine is working correctly. So it gives you some amount of protection, but nothing is perfect. What else is new? The person who we've been keeping waiting an awful long time is, I think, November 1, Mike Juliet, if I got the call correctly. I think it's Mark. Over to you, Mark, K2RIW in the second hand.
K-A-2-Y-H-Y.
K-A-2-Y-H-Y. Start with your name and your comment, sir.
Hi, good evening. Take name here is Steve. Steve, the question was, what would the GFCI set the trip at? Nominally 5 milliamps, 4 to 6 is what they trip at.
That's good to know, Steve. And is that the trip current regardless of what kind of a GFI? If I've got a 5 ampere or a 30 ampere GFI, they all trip at somewhere around 5 milliamperes, Steve. Go ahead.
That is true today for what's known as Class A GFCIs. They used to be Class Bs some years back, but no one makes them anymore. But for personnel protection, Class A GFCIs, 5 milliamperes, irrespective of what the overcurrent limit is, if it's a circuit breaker type.
Okay, and thank you, Steve. Good information. Go ahead, Glenn.
Dick, just keep in mind the GFI is only looking for a current path from either one of the hot legs to the ground, not returning to neutral or going from hot leg to hot leg. As soon as it develops anywhere between 5 and 10 milliamps, that's when that breaker trips out. That ground pin on the GFI is the detector for that.
Okay, Glenn. Thank you. Paul, WS2N, you said you had a space report, and Grail might be one of your items on space. And I'm seeing the microwave people are starting to tool up to listen to the S-band downlink of Grail. Grail is that thing that was launched a day or so ago, which is going to be a pair of satellites going around the moon for something like a year or so. I think they're going to be operational starting in December. And by way of the very precise measurement of the spacing, altitude, and whatever of those two satellites, they're going to be measuring the mass concentrations on the moon. And therefore, they intend to figure out, was there a second moon around the Earth at one time that went splat with our moon? Right now, there's a bunch of computer models that say, since the back side of the moon is so different in terrain compared to the front side, that it really represents a different chunk of material that collided. WS2N, K2RIW, you got a poll.
Okay, did we leave Mel out with his mailbag? What happened there?
Very good point. I better check with Mel. KE2EJ, let me apologize, K2RIW. I kind of thought Mel would not be there because we went so darn late that the people he's addressing usually are at sleep at this time already, so I've made the mistake of bypassing him. Oh well, we'll have to make up for it next week. You got it, Paul.
Okay, very good. Yeah, Grail, they had wind problems the first day, and it was supposed to go off on the 8th. And then had a heater that in the Delta rocket, the launch vehicle. And they corrected that, and they almost had another wind problem, but it finally got off to a successful launch. And it does take a couple of months to get to the moon. It's not like the Apollo missions where you're there in 3.5 days. This goes to big long orbits around the Earth until you get to the moon, and then when you do get to the moon, you'll be in a polar orbit. And they'll launch together. They're about maybe 4 feet high, but 4 foot square roughly. cube, you might say. So you have a Grail, A, and Grail B, and they you know, separated from the Delta rocket correctly, so they're independently flying to the moon, and they'll be in the polar orbit. One is at the very end of the year, New Year's Eve, and the other one is New Year's Day. They'll be going into orbit and drop it. And then it's going to take, you know, a couple of months to get a low circular orbit. It was 34 miles above the surface, which is relatively low. Apollo, you know, the command module used to be about 60 miles above, so roughly halfway between the surface and where they used to orbit. And it's a nice orbit, actually, for pictures. The lunar reconnaissance orbiter has taken some nice pictures. You can see quite clearly the landers, you know, from Apollo 17 and 12, Apollo 14. You can see the they can see the footprints on the moon surface. You can see the rover sitting there that they used on Apollo 17. So it's a very low orbit. They do have cameras aboard these two spacecraft, and they'll take accurate distance measurements between the two when they change. These mass cons, these mass concentrations, is called mass cons. When they used to go to orbit, you used to hear that all the time. That would change the flight path a little bit. Let me drop it. US-2N. That's what happened with Apollo 11. They got downrange a lot further than they thought. They were little bit off. They said that's partially due to different gravity locations around the moon. So they want to accurately measure these things, and then in future flights, when you have either manned or unmanned flights, you'll be able to land accurately. If you want to, you know, land right next to a particular rock, you'll be able to do it once all this data is in. The data won't start rolling until around March. They'll start getting that data. So, that's a good flight. I know we talked about it a couple of times on the net. And I was glad to see Grail get off the ground. Big difference between this and the Juno flight. That made it out to the moon in less than a day. So, depending on the size of the rocket, and of course, Juno is a lot bigger spacecraft. That's the one that's heading out to Jupiter right now. So very good. I also wanted to talk about a couple of other things. The supernova, let me drop it. Go out and look at that with binoculars. Very, very faint. It looks on September 9th. That's supposed to be the brightest day. And I looked at the location where they said, and sure, I saw what looked like a star there, but I thought it would be brighter. And then I could see other little stars here and there, you know. So, you know, it's really hard to tell whether you're looking at it or not. But based on the dimensions that they gave, I can only tell for sure. If I go out, let's say a month from now, and I go up and look on a nice clear night, and I find out there's nothing in that location, then I'll know I was looking at that supernova that they've been talking about for the last a couple of weeks. One other thing Wesley brought up a few weeks ago was the, he brought up, trying to think what N2XJN was talking about, the details, but to make a long story short, he was talking about a rocket that blew up from Russia. The spacecraft that they launch, and the Soyuz manned spacecraft, launched by proton rockets, and when it got to about four or five minutes up, one of the parts, you know, caused the rocket to blow up, and there was big worry that at the time, not on the NASA site, but other sites, that Oh my goodness, this is our only way to bring astronauts to the ISS right now. And will we have to cancel this whole problem? We have to bring people back, abandon the spacecraft. Are we going to let the robot take over that's up there? So there's been a lot of talk.
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
Thing that NASA has wrote about. I think they're not too worried about it because the other day the Russians have figured out what the problem was. There's a manufacturing problem in their rocket, and they're looking to correct that now. So right now there are plans on launching further rockets, either with Progress supply ships or Soyuz manned spacecraft back to the International Space Station. But they're going to triple check and make sure that the third stage doesn't have the same problems that the one that blew up did. And they're looking to correct that. NASA is working very closely with the Russians. And they're passing information back and forth. I think that problem is going to be resolved, but the thought of abandoning the space station for a while is kind of unnerving. You can do that, but they sure don't want to after over 10 years of manned operation. So that's the three topics I wanted to cover, Dick. Back to you, WS-20.
The microwave amateurs are now sending messages back and forth to each other as to how they have to modify their 2300 megacycle converters, microwave converters, so that they can listen to the ground link, the downlink directly from Grail, and some of them are hoping they're going to be able to get some of the pictures directly from it. So because it's a relatively close mission to the Earth, there's a chance they can do that. When it comes to listening to, when it comes to observing the supernova, I think some of the programs I've seen or websites have said that you require something like a 15 by 70 set of binoculars, 15 gain, 70 millimeter forward diameter. It takes a good size set of binoculars because it's a rather dim star or a moderate sized telescope. So a typical person owns binoculars that are 7 by 35. Gain of 7 and 35 millimeters for the forward aperture, and that's below the requirement unless you've got an extremely good set of eyes in a very dark locale, like I think it's called Cherry Valley, Pennsylvania. There's a place which the local community has tried very hard to make it super dark so that the astronomer people will go there and use that particular campsite, so to speak. So from what I can tell, even though the Progress ship didn't arrive with all the materials that were required, there's enough backup materials, and for the time being, there's no conversation about lowering the number of astronauts that are on the ISS, which I think is 6 astronauts. Is that true? Astronauts, cosmonauts? I think there's 6 people there. Is that true? For the first time in a long time, you got it, Paul.
It's been, I guess, a couple of years now that they've had 6 up there. Ever since they put that cupola thing up there, that was, probably 2 years now. Steady 6 people. That means 2 Soyuz spacecraft docked all the time, ready to go as lifeboats back to Earth. And you have a lifespan of about 10 months with those things, so you know you can't change plans in the middle and say, well, let's leave everybody there and we'll see what happens with this proton rocket, see if they're going to straighten us out. You know, they would have to bring them back. They can't say, well, let's leave them up there for another year. Who cares? You know, there's a problem with the spacecraft. They're only designed for 10 months docking. So they would have to, you know, if they can't send another crew up, these crews will come back. They're not going to stay there and dawdle around up there and waiting to find out the results. They will come back, and they would have to abandon the space station. You know, they've got this robot on the outside that it's controlled by NASA. I don't know if you've ever seen this thing. Let me drop it. Well, Dextra, D-E-X-T-R-E. I'm talking about it when it went up. It's quite large. But I mean, it's got all kinds of arms and legs and torso, and it don't look like a person, but it could do everything a person could do. And there's a 5-minute video of you. I saw on one of the NASA sites of this thing taking out a circuit breaker. I mean, it doesn't look like a circuit breaker like you have in our house. You know, it's like a white box. Looks like about maybe 4 by 3 by 6. You know, it's a box that can be turned off. You know, you got to open up the panel, and then you pull this box out. It's got a dial on it. I don't know. But you pull the box out. It's got this locking feature that you have to unlock before you pull the box out. And then you got to put a new one in. This one was faulty. And they show on this video, this robot, and they show it at fast speed, so it looks like it's really going good. And crawling across the space station and going up to this box to change out the circuit breaker. Let me drop it. This is WS2N. And it's real cool. I mean, you know, they have close-up cameras, you know, similar to helmet cams that they have when the astronauts are working. You just see the hands. You see this thing close up, you know, going up to this box, opening the box, reaching in, you know, disconnect, you know, throwing this mechanical mechanism over from lock to unlock, pulling the circuit breaker out, you know, pulling it out, spinning around in space. You see, you know, it's in one arm, and then the other one is, you know, the one that's going to be replacing it is in the other arm. And it puts the new one in, closes the box, and covers, you know, puts the locking mechanism in. It's really unbelievable. And this was all done while the crew was on board sleeping. And they had nothing to do with it. I mean, the people in mission control, it was, you know, doing this thing all remotely. It's really a cool robot. Back to you, Dick. WS1.
Yeah, John's got a question, and so do I. My first question is Dextry a battery-operated robot? Because if it's powered from the space station and it's throwing circuit breakers that could disconnect its power, you can see where I'm going on that one. Over to you for a quick one, Paul.
Okay. It's applied, you know, it latches onto different parts of the spacecraft. In this case, it was on a robot arm, the Canadian robot arm, and it was moving around. So it will get power from the spacecraft, but it's got batteries, you know, on board, I guess. I would assume. I never thought about it, but yeah, I mean, it's not going to run out of power. You know, you got to remember, there's probably hundreds of these circuit breakers all over the space station. There's just one small area that needed to be changed out. So, you know, it's not like they're going to pull the breaker and, you know, the whole system's going to shut down. Back to you, John.
Thank you, Paul. John, you got it. KC2WGB, K2LIW on the TechNet.
I'm pushing for Paul. Paul, what is the limiting factor on those two lifeboats that are sitting up there? Why are they only good for 10 months? Consumables, or I would assume they're in a shutdown mode. So what's going on with that, do you know?
And along with that, Paul, I'd like to know, the Soyuz return vehicles, what is their history of reliability? Are they 99% always effective? And I'm guessing that the astronauts and cosmonauts have a slightly rougher landing on Soyuz because I think it lands on land, not on water. WS2N, K2LIW.
I know they have power issues with the Soyuz spacecraft. You know, I guess they keep everything charged and everything fine going with the... I don't know if they have a jumper system for the Soyuz like they have with the shuttle when it went up. Probably not. So I think it's battery issues, power issues. they probably use fuel cells similar to the space shuttle. I don't know, but it's probably power issues. Also, the fuel, you know, you don't want to. These things are all pressurized for, you know, months at a time. You know, that might be an issue too. You know, they might say, hey, you know, all our valves, O-rings and stuff are only good for, you know, a year or two. Let's not push our luck. You know, maybe they give them a certain time on that. But probably just, you know, power issues. Make sure everything is, you know, up and running. Batteries will, you know, tend to start to go down. You know, these things are, they're really independent the whole time. They really are lifeboats. If there's a fire on board or some kind of decompression, they jump into these things and move. And, you know, they get away from the spacecraft. Let me drop it. Not too long ago, they had three people on board. And when two people are doing a spacewalk, the flight rules were, I'm going to try to think, that the other person has to sit inside the Soyuz spacecraft, ready to go. So, I mean, they've got all these rules. I mean, you can't have all the, you know, fuel connections or plug connections sitting on the, attached to this thing, recharging it. I can't imagine that. I would imagine that, you know, they have to be able to jump it, push a button, and off they go. So that's probably the main problem. And Dick, you had a question?
Yeah, what is the demonstrated reliability of Soyuz as a landing craft? Has anyone that ever came back to Earth did so successfully? No parachute failures, hard landings, or whatever?
I think of a woman's name. You want a W. I got her name. I'll have to look on the computer. She was, I think she was commanded there for a while. And when she came back on Soyuz, they had a rough landing. One of the thrusters didn't activate right, and they didn't come. You know, there's supposed to be, you know, a certain angle that they got to come in. If they come in too shallow, they'll heat up and burn up. If they come in, if they come in too steep, they'll burn up. If they go in too shallow, they'll skip off. That type of thing. Well, they went long, and to correct it, it changed everything. And to make a long story short, because of this change, they had a very hard landing. So she wasn't too happy about that. I'll have to look her name up. One problem early on, coming back, Soyuz, the Salyut 7, let me drop it. 7 space station. Everybody thinks there's only two space stations. You know, we have the International Space Station and Skylab, but of course the Russians had the Mir, and then they had Salyut 7, Salyut 6, and coming back from, I think it was Salyut 7, one of the valves didn't open, and was spun. I think the valve opened. They didn't know it was. I have to look this one up. But I think it was a mistake, and you know, somebody was supposed to shut this thing, and they didn't. Whatever, and three people suffocated on the way back. It might have been two. I think it might have been two back in those days. So not 100% reliability, but probably out of the 100 or so shots that they've done, or more than that, you know, it's pretty reliable there.
Yeah, it seems like fairly similar to shuttle reliability. We've had a failure on launch, and we've had a failure on landing. So it looks like there's fairly similar numbers there. Okay, thank you for full information, Paul.
One more question, Dick.
Go right ahead, John.
Paul, one last question. Do they use the Soyuz craft for any orbit or course corrections? Do they use those engines on there at all?
They use the Progress spacecraft. Those things come with fuel. but not the Soyuz. They can. I mean, they can if they had to. But the space shuttle was the main source of that. They would push the every time it was up there, they push the whole space station up another 14 miles. But now they do that with the Progress on a regular basis, because the Progress they don't bring back. I mean, nothing burns up over the Pacific Ocean, John. So, you know, if they have a lot of extra fuel, let's say, you know, what happens is they have a certain amount of fuel to dock with the space station. And if they don't use that up, you know, let's say they have to do two or three tries, you know, if they won't have much fuel left, then they might not do it. But if there's a lot of fuel on board, before they undock, they'll try to push the space station up a higher altitude. There's been a lot of fuel that has been brought up. You do have fuel on the ISS. There's thrusters and everything, so it could lift itself up to some degree. And this is what's going to be going on for many years. The good news is, let me drop it. Elves are being done now on the new Orion spacecraft, or the, I guess they're going to call it the multi-crew vehicle, but, you know, the Orion spacecraft, which is being built for future manned flights by, you know, by NASA. So, I mean, you've actually got work being done now on this thing, so hopefully maybe it'll accelerate the pace, because it is designed. One of the things you'll be able to do with this is go to the International Space Station with it. So that'll help, you know. I mean, you get those things up there with a couple of other modules and fuel, and they'll be able to do anything they want, bring people up. I hope they go that way. That was on the NASA site that they're using, in fact, using a welding technique that I really am not that familiar with. It's pretty new. It's some kind of a vibration mixing type of weld. They don't use heat. So it's really strange. Back to you, Dick, WS1.
Let me give another call for, I think it was Mark. November 1, Mike Juliet in Connecticut, who signed in earlier. Are you still there? And we didn't give Mel a chance. Did you have any further information you wanted to give us? K2KEY, K2RIW. Okay. Did I skip anybody that signed in tonight? Looks like I didn't. It looks like we're ready to go into the deeper stuff, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW. You got it, John.
All right, Dick. I just thought I'd let you know I started the vertical profile on my seismometer. I found a great way of dampening, and I'm getting excellent results with the vertical actuator now. So all I'm going to need is two more coils, exactly the same, and I'll have a three-axis seismometer. But thanks for your help. It's working out pretty well.
Yeah, one of the things I recommend you do is simply Google the word seismometer, seismograph or seismometer. And on that first page that Google will give you, there's some nice pictures of homebrew or kit form seismometers. And one of them is a vertical seismometer, which looks like a frame with a great big horizontal triangle. There is what you and I would call a boom that looks like the boom of a sailboat. On the end of the boom is a mast. Not too far from the end of the boom is a horseshoe magnet. And they've got a horseshoe magnet that moves up and down against a pancake coil that's on the base. And the suspension for this thing is not straight up from the ceiling. The suspension is a very long coil spring from the tip of the boom to the top of the mast. Make believe this is a sailboat. And so the boom of the sail of the sailboat is really the seismometer. And there's a very nice picture of that. And somewhere along the length of the boom, they've got a rod going down into a pot of oil. and I think there's a metal plate on the bottom of that rod. So by deciding where to position the pot of oil along the boom, somewhere from the pivot point all the way out to the end, you can adjust the amount of damping factor. It looks like a fairly easy to duplicate vertical seismometer design, and obviously a horizontal version of that would be even easier to construct once you use that method of construction. So if you do Google the word seismometer, you'll get a beautiful picture of a particular kit that you can buy, and to homebrew that looks very doable.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Over to you, John. K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, just so I make sure I understand you, we have a boom and we have a vertical mast. So the spring would be the hypotenuse. Is that how the spring is set up?
You got it. You go to that picture. It's about the third item when you simply Google the word seismometer. About the third item down is a series of pictures. And so exactly, the long coil spring is the hypotenuse from the top of the mast to the outer end of the boom is the long coil spring. And the boom itself is vertically pivoted. And as I described it, it looks like that method of construction can give you a lot of sensitivity and a lot of adaptability in the damping factor just by moving that rod, where the attachment point of the rod along the boom, which goes into the oil pan, pot of oil that's on the deck of the ship, if you know what I mean. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Yeah, that sounds like a doable setup. And sort of simple. If I'm going to do that, I'll probably get that done tonight. By the way, this time, what I did was I made a vertical support. I took my stainless steel tie wrap, that little flat piece of metal, that's about, well, now it's about 300 millimeters long, and I bent it in a Z-fold fashion, and I put about a 1-inch by 1-inch by half-inch piece of steel on the end of it, and I took all of my neodymium magnets, the roll of quarters as we were talking about, I just stuck it to the bottom of that and let that hang in the coil. Beautiful dampening. It doesn't keep oscillating, and very sensitive, extremely sensitive. So I will definitely look up that website and try that too, because that sounds like something doable.
Are you saying that you were accomplishing magnetic dampening?
No, that was purely mechanical dampening. The Z fold, rather than doing it in an S, there's maybe picture three Z's, and then when you pull it, they straighten out, they elongate. That was enough. When I stop it, if I don't hit it hard, it will not oscillate. It just hangs there by itself. The quiescent signal is perfect. Any magnetic or geodetic disturbance, it goes right to the chart recorder. And when the event is over, it stops. It doesn't keep oscillating. So that worked pretty well.
Now, I'm not quite sure what the Z-fold is doing. I can see a piece of metal tie wrap that has been Z-folded, and that is a kind of a springy material. And bear in mind now that everything you do for damping has to create heat. That's the reason why the cotton ball didn't do very much dampening. The so-called shock absorber on an automobile, when you're driving over a rough road, it gets hot. That's how it stops the sway of the car. It's turning the kinetic energy of motion of the car, swinging back and forth on its suspension springs, and turning it into heat. So, and when you're sloshing around some oil, you are creating heat. And so, does this Z-fold device, what's the mechanism by it creates heat? Was it magnetically moving in front of your roll of quarters? I don't yet have the picture of where the Z-fold is going from to, and what is it going near. Over to you, John.
Okay, first understand the coil is, the solenoid coil that I've been describing is now vertical with the air core pointing straight up. About 2 feet above that, I have a rod coming out of my instrument rack that I hang the stainless steel strap on, and it is bent in Z, like I said. At the bottom of that is the little square metal plate with the neodymium magnets stuck to the bottom of that. So now when I add that weight, which is pretty massive, it stretches out that Z-fold and then stabilizes at a point and does not move. It, and if I get an event, it'll react and then stop. So exactly how that damping is working, I don't fully understand, but it works perfectly.
The Z-fold device, in the method by which you're using it, when it's suspending the magnet at the bottom, what's the total length from top to bottom? And although it's critically damped, what do you believe is the natural resonant frequency?
The natural resonant frequency is still around 1 second. Now picture this. Let's say we had that strap and it was a foot long. And we took a 4-inch piece, bent it over, and you would, you know how you make a Z-fold, and you just keep doing that. Now, of course, we have a flat piece with maybe 4 layers. When we take one end of that and hang it, put a weight on the other, it elongates it, straightens it out. So instead of Z's now, we have like little slash marks, like a forward slash and a backward slash. That's how it looks, and it's hanging straight down vertically right into the coil.
And in the way you're using it, from top to bottom, is what dimension? How many inches tall is that?
It's about 250 millimeters. There'll be 8, 9, 10, 10 inches, 11 inches maybe.
And over those 11 inches, there are how many bends of that Z-fold?
3.5.
Yeah, I can tell by this very long hypotenuse spring that you're going to see when you look at those pictures. They're looking for much, much lower natural resonant frequencies, like 10 cycles or 10 seconds or 100 seconds, because some of the data they want to measure is 0.001 hertz, 1,000th of a hertz, is some of the data they want to measure. So that very long hypotenuse spring, which I guess could be a very long Z-fold, but a real coil spring. I worry about the Z-fold slowly creeping up and down as a function of temperature, because you know, you're leaving a number of partially relieved stresses as you bend that into a Z-fold. And for that matter, a coil spring is also going to have a temperature characteristic if it's not made out of just the right materials. So temperature compensation is going to be a little bit of a problem. The nice thing about the picture of this, let me call it a sailboat type of vertical seismometer, which can very easily be made into a horizontal version by letting the boom swing left and right as opposed to up and down, changing the slight pivot point mechanism. They use a knife edge as the pivot point where the boom meets the mast. And the knife edge, of course, is set up in such a way that it favors the particular direction you want, up and down or left and right. Temperature compensation, we talked about that, resonant frequency. You'll see some, when you just Google the word seismometer, you'll see some nice curves of frequency responses of various mechanisms that they've made, and what's the advantage of the low, medium, and high frequencies of seismographic indications. And they do want to go down to some super low frequencies. Also, when it comes to recording the data, I've had a brief discussion with my son on this one, and I've got some suggestions on that one when you're ready for it, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Yeah, that will be great. Also, I have a question. Now, you have a description of the device I'm using, the Z-fold strap. I know it has an elongation factor because just as it sits there with the weight, it's slowly going to adjust. But the thermal characteristics, I think, are more, it's going to affect my device more than a larger mass spring, would it not?
There I don't know. I suspect that somebody in the world sells a spring that when you stretch it a reasonable amount, because of its method of construction, the materials that were used, it's possible to make a spring that has very low temperature coefficient of expansion. I just believe that that's possible. Or, conversely, you can make sure that it's always in a constant temperature room to compensate for that. Or, you could precisely measure its drift versus temperature, precisely measure the temperature in the room, and compensate the data accordingly. So there's multiple ways of getting around that. But that very long hypotenuse spring can give you a much, much longer time constant. I've got a gut feel you're going to want a longer time constant eventually, John. I think some of the things you're going to look for are sub-hertz, if you know what I mean. KC2WGB, K2RYW.
Yeah, that sounds like a very interesting and very simple way to go. I did find that this new system that I made, it has, it's very compliant with an event, but I was not getting those disturbed, little annoying peaks and valleys that I was getting before. If a little breeze would blow by, it was affecting my other devices. This is very stable, but that other system, how were they detecting the energy? Was it a magnetic? You said they had a horseshoe magnet hanging over a pancake coil, I believe, right? Roughly, what was the diameter from what you saw of that spring? Was it like quarter inch or a half inch diameter spring? Could you perceive that?
On the sailboat seismometer design, those are my words for it. My guess is, I don't remember seeing dimensions, but if I had to make a guess, the boom of the sailboat looked to me like it was a foot and a half long. The mast looked like it was a foot and a half high. The helical spring going from the tip of the mast to the tip of the boom was a spring all the way the whole length. If I had to make the guess, the spring was close to an inch in diameter and a zillion turns to it. So it had a very long time constant. Because of the size of the mast they used and the length of the spring and the length of the boom, I think their natural resonant frequency was 10 seconds or 100 seconds per cycle is my rough guess. And by sliding the dash pot, the pool of oil with the rod coming down from the boom going into a disc that's in the oil into this pot of oil, by sliding it along the boom, you can easily adjust whatever damping factor you want without changing the viscosity of the oil, the size of the plate. You got a whole lot of adjustment capability there with that particular design. Now, the magnet, let me drop. Near the end of the boom, there was a horseshoe-shaped magnet. The horseshoe-shaped magnet was like an upside-down U with the opening of the magnet aimed downward. The two tangs of the horseshoe-shaped magnet were across the boom, transverse to the boom, hanging downward, parallel to the boom but perpendicular to the earth was an air coil, a pancake air coil. So the pancake air coil is perpendicular to the earth, parallel to the boom, the coil itself. The axis of the coil was transverse to the boom. The horseshoe magnet overlapped half of the pancake coil. So now as the boom moves up and down and the horseshoe-shaped magnet moves up and down, you can see how the tips of the horseshoe-shaped magnet are getting closer or further from the center axis of this pancake coil. If you've got a computer right now and you simply Google the word seismometer and you look at that picture, or I can tell you which one to go, you're going to see something that's really beautiful and easy to duplicate. I wonder if you're near a computer, John, K2RYW.
Not at this time, Dick. I'm not able to do that, but I will get to that tonight, without a doubt. Let me ask you, the diameter of the coil, is it larger than the magnet width?
I'm going to guess now that the horseshoe-shaped magnet, I'm going to make a guess, was 2 inches tall across the U. In other words, the depth of U is roughly 2 inches, I'm going to guess. The gap across the outer tangs of the horseshoe-shaped magnet, I'm going to guess, were close to half an inch, maybe a little bit more. The air coil, the pancake-shaped air coil, I'm going to guess, was something in the vicinity of 2.5 inches in diameter. And the thickness of the air coil, in other words, along its axis, was almost filling up the whole gap on the horseshoe-shaped magnet. So there was very little air gap between the horseshoe-shaped magnet and this air coil. It's a solenoid air coil where the length of the solenoid is extremely short. That's why I'm calling it a pancake coil. It looked to me like the coil had, I'll pick a number, 30 or 40 layers to it from center to out, from center diameter to outer diameter. But its z-axis, its axial length of the pancake coil was almost the length that would fill up the gap of the horseshoe-shaped magnet. By that mechanism, the smallest amount of vertical movement of that boom is going to make a huge difference in the total amount of magnetic field that hits the center of that air coil, if you see what I mean. You get a lot of sensitivity out of that arrangement. And so whether or not the magnet is super strong, like a neodymium magnet or just an old-fashioned U-shaped Alnico magnet, might be a minor factor. Over to you, John.
KC2, QIQ.
Ben, recognize. Dick, I don't have a magnet that small, but I can probably get one. Now, the diameter of the air core part of it, was that about an inch or a half inch, or was it wound totally from the center?
No, it wasn't totally from the center. It looks to me like the center diameter was about a half inch, and the outer diameter, I would say, is 2 inches, in that order. And I would say top to bottom, along the z-axis of the air coil, it was in the vicinity of a half inch or a third of an inch, just enough to almost fill up the air gap between the two tangs of the U-shaped horseshoe magnet. KC2QIQ, K2RIW, I wonder if you've ever worked with or built a seismometer, Glenn, go ahead.
Not that type, Dick, actually. I've done some experiments with it, but actually doing it with microphones that were buried, but different setup altogether. Actually, I just broke in real quick here. I didn't want to interrupt you guys, but just to ask if I could ask a question maybe after you're finished with this topic. Slightly different topic, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, we can flip back and forth. Let's take your question now, Glenn, and then we'll go back to what John and I are discussing. You got it, Glenn.
Yeah, mine's a little bit different. I've been experimenting again with vertical antennas and making some measurements, and one of the antennas that I've been experimenting with recently is a halfway vertical. And I had another antenna that actually was what they called a stacked antenna, which I really didn't understand. They called it a vertical stack, where they take basically two dual-band antennas, they put a capacitive coupling in between, and they stack the next one up on top of it, which apparently gives it more bandwidth. Let me let this drop for a second. So while trying to understand this antenna, I started taking it apart and making lots of measurements on it, and it led me to work on a half-wave antenna, in which basically I sawed it in the middle, made two quarter-wave antennas, put a capacitive coupling in between it, and then just basically retuned the antenna again to see what kind of results I have. Oddly enough, it tunes very similarly, but I wind up with more bandwidth. Do you have any idea what's going on here? K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
You sound like you're making a half-wave antenna. You first started off with a vertical half-wave antenna, and I'm assuming you're feeding it from the bottom. You didn't say. And then you broke it up. You chopped it in the center, put a capacitor there. Let me think now. With a capacitor in the center, you'd have to make it a little bit longer in order to reestablish resonance. So once you reestablish resonance of a slightly longer antenna, I think you're saying that the standing wave ratio of bandwidth appear to be greater. Is all of that approximately right, Glenn? Go ahead.
Yeah, pretty much. What I saw is that the when I was taking apart this other antenna that had the stacked, it was basically two dual band, 2 meter 440 antennas, and I took one of the little capacitive coupling parts from the middle, put it up on the top, and then that's what I put in between the two quarter wave lengths, and then I remeasured the half wave antenna. It had very, very similar VSWR matching, just a slight retuning, and then basically looked at the bandwidth, and it increased. And I'm just wondering, is there something to this, or is it maybe just an error in measurement, or maybe it just needs to be looked at a little bit closer?
So I think it's possible. You haven't told us what frequency you're doing this on. Is this 2 meters and 440, Glenn?
Yeah, Dick, actually what this is it started off with a 2 meter 440 antenna fed from the bottom, just like you said, and that was what the original antenna was. And then basically that's when I started thinking, how is this actually working and how to model it. And right now I've actually created my own version of it as a 2 meter 440 antenna by just, you know, retuning it manually and making measurements. And I made another mobile antenna now that I'm going to connect to a mount. But it actually covers, like, from 144 all the way up to 148 on 2 meters. And now it's covering pretty much the whole 70-centimeter band in one vertical whip that's about 63 inches tall. And I'm very, very amazed by this, and I'm just trying to model it. I mean, my measurements so far basically have been just, you know, cutting lengths and... putting them back together with the original style resonators that came with the original Optec antenna. And I'm very, very impressed with the performance, but I still don't really quite understand how this is working.
Okay, there's quite a number of variables to talk about here. First of all, when you have a solid half-wave piece of wire fed from the bottom, you're feeding something in the vicinity of 1,000 ohm impedance, so therefore you had some kind of a impedance step-up device. The bandwidth of your impedance step-up device is definitely a factor here. Second of all, when you cut it in the middle and put a capacitor there, how many picofarad did you put, or what is the capacitor reactance? You had to make it a little bit longer. Now the bottom impedance is a little bit different. You've got to readjust that impedance step-up device at the bottom. And so the new stepped-up impedance, well, I think it's a higher impedance, not positive for that, it again has a slightly different bandwidth. So is the antenna really the thing that's giving you the bandwidth? And if so, during your measurements of bandwidth, VSWR bandwidth, and I presume you're looking at the bandwidth over which it hits 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, for instance, and hopefully in the center it goes down to 1-to-1. If antenna A and antenna B, one goes down to 1-to-1 in the center frequency and one goes down to 1.5, there's other variables involved. Size of the ground plane is a variable. What's around it? Are you feeding it as a dual band? Lots of variables here. But first of all, what was the bandwidth of the pure half-wave wire versus the pure half-wave wire with the capacitor in the center, and how many picofarad do you think that capacitor was? And how were you doing that impedance step up at the bottom? Over to you, Glenn.
Okay, when I first started with this, with the half-wave whip, I basically took the an existing half-wave match that I had, and I had the whip length basically the two quarter wave lengths in a solid piece of wire, and my VSWR with that was somewhere like around 1.3-to-1 at the dip, and my total bandwidth going say the 2-to-1 on either side without any coupling or anything inside the middle was somewhere like, you know, roughly about 2 megahertz of maximum bandwidth, kind of like saying with 146 in the middle, go to 147 on one end and maybe to 145 on the other at best. And then when I cut it in the middle and I used this little 100 picofarad coupling device that came with the Optec antenna that was split between the two stacks on the other design, and I put it in between, it's about 100 puff roughly, and it's about an inch and a half in total length in between where it screws down on both halves of the antenna. And I was able to, by adjusting two new pieces, I said I cut it in half, but that's not really completely true. I kind of took new stock, and I kind of played with the lengths, and actually got the match pretty darn close to 1-to-1 with that little coupling piece inside the middle, and I wound up with basically what I believe to be a real half-wave antenna now, but now it covers on 2 meters from almost 144 to 148. I picked up an extra 2 megahertz. Does that make any sense, Dick? K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
Okay, 100 picofarad at 145 megacycles is approximately 11 ohms of capacitive reactance. So, assuming your center impedance of a half-wave dipole is in the vicinity of 70 ohms, and you're putting a 10-ohm capacitive reactance there, it means you've got to lengthen the antenna a little bit so that it develops 10 ohms of inductive reactance to reestablish resonance. That's if this was a pure world. but the world's not pure. You haven't yet told me what is doing the 50 ohms to 1,000 ohms step-up impedance at the bottom. And that step-up impedance device is another reactor. In other words, there's a zillion ways you can build up that step-up impedance device. It itself, from its feed point, could represent an inductor to earth, or a capacitor to earth, or a pure 1,000 ohm resistor to earth. It is also changing the electrical length of the radiator. So, what is the nature of that impedance step-up device? Glenn, go ahead.
Well, the bottom feed part was part of an old diamond antenna that I had. It was a dual-band PL259-type screw mount in that was originally for a dual-band, I think it was for half-wave, dual-band 2-meter to 70-centimeter. So I kind of used that, and then I put the length, just took a solid length and pretty much just put one piece in there to and cut it to length so that it would make it a half-wave 2-meter antenna. But I said the VSWR match there wasn't really, adjusting the length on that bottom device from the old diamond dual-band antenna, I couldn't get it exactly one-to-one. It basically bottomed somewhere like around 1.3 to 1 in the center, and then at best. But it was interesting, when I cut the antenna in the middle, and like you said, made just a ball pass just almost a little bit longer, I was able to achieve a much, much better match and wider bandwidth. But it's very confusing. I don't exactly know what's inside that bottom match, though, from the old diamond antenna. Back to you, the KTOR-IW KC2 QIQ.
Yeah, that bottom device, it's probably intended to go on the roof of an automobile or a mag mount or whatever. Many of them have a multi-turn coil, sometimes a printed circuit coil, where the 50-ohm wire is tapped up on one of those turns. So it's a kind of a step-up transformer with no real tuning capacitor to it. The antenna does the tuning. And that's the way it's often done, not always. So the reactance of your base device, the impedance mismatch, the fact that you hit a 1.3 VSWR with a solid piece of wire, means that you're stepping up to 1,000 ohms and the antenna was only 800 ohms or something like that, if you know what I mean. And whether or not, yeah, you did hit resonance, so you had a dip, that's not the problem. That's the remaining reactance. It's a resistance, it's a resistive mismatch, most likely. That's on the assumption that the base device is acting like a pure resistor at 146 megs. We don't know that. And there's ways of measuring that to confirm it. Let me drop. So you've got a lot of variables here. Ordinarily, a dipole, as you go up in frequency, becomes more inductive at the center. If you go down in frequency, it becomes more capacitive at the center feeding point. And feeding it from one end, although the magnitudes change, you get the same phenomenon. By putting a capacitor in the center and making it longer, you do now have a longer length of radiating structure. More of the wave is going to be radiated. That means the base impedance, I think, is going to slightly drop. And so when you put the capacitor in the center and you made it a little bit longer, you've got a better VSWR. That implies that the base step-up impedance device was lower in impedance than ideal for the pure half-wave piece of wire. And now impedance becoming lower when you made the wire longer came closer to the right impedance. That's why you get a better VSWR. Bunch of guesses here. Now, what you really got is a collinear pair of quarter waves with a capacitor coupling between the two. And if you look at the reference, if you look at the antenna engineering handbook under the subject of collinear antennas, you see quite a different ways of building vertical collinear antennas with capacitors in the center, with inductors in the center, with half-wave resonators in the center that don't radiate. There's a zillion ways of building a multi-element collinear antenna. In general, multi-element collinear antennas are more narrowband. However, this rather simple half-wave to a pair of stacked quarter waves with a coupling capacitor might not fall prey to that. So, was the extra bandwidth because of what you did with the radiator, with the capacitor in the center, or was it because of what's going on with the base impedance step-up device? There's a number of variables there. In theory, you can computer model the impedance step-up device in the bottom, if you can take it apart and make its physical measurements, or with difficulty with a network analyzer,